Well, great. Thank you so much to Lionel for inviting me here and for putting together really what's been a tremendous day of learning, particularly for myself, being an American-born, American-trained attorney and now academic. I'm Leah Chan-Greenwald. As mentioned, I am the dean as well as the Richard J. Morgan Professor of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And so, yes, I do live in Las Vegas. it is not like what you think. It's more fun. and so I am really honored to be able to share what is happening across the pond, as it were. Just want to say, as you probably can anticipate, that my views are my own and not of my institution. And so my outline for my segment is two items. I'm going to discuss two forms of abuse of intellectual property rights in the U.S. The first is the fraud on the patent office. And then the second is trademark bullying, which has been an area of passion of mine, just like Amandine's with abuse of IP rights. But first, let's have a little humor. We are late. I am the cleanup crew for the day. And so I just want to give you this cartoon. And so I can see from the laughs, you've gotten the American humor, but just in case you haven't, this is basically making fun of lawyers in general, which I actually quite enjoy, lawyer jokes, but in particular, trademark lawyers, as well as plaintiff lawyers who may work on a contingency fee basis. And this joke makes a little more sense when you look at the rules and regulation of the United States Patent and Trademark Office for patent and trademark prosecution. And so this is just a short background for those of you not familiar with practice before the PTO. So under the patent side, inventors can file for their own patents, but research show that about 92% of applicants will use a registered practitioner. And in order to be a registered practitioner, you need to have a science background and take the patent bar exam. Interestingly, though, you don't actually need to be an attorney to take the patent bar exam. You can just have a science background and take the patent bar exam. If you pass, you can be a registered patent agent. If you are a trained attorney, licensed attorney, you still need to take the patent bar exam. It's a separate exam from the regular exam. Then you can practice and prosecute patents before the PTO. On the trademark side, as you can probably guess at from the cartoon I showed you, a little less rigorous. Again, applicants can file, purported trademark holders can file their own applications. Here we see, and this is from empirical work from colleagues, about 75% of applicants use an attorney. As you could probably imagine, those that use the attorneys on either side or a patent agent on the patent side are more successful in general. The PTO doesn't really care who files a trademark application, to be honest. There is no separate registration process for attorneys. So it is currently hard to keep track of who really is before the office. And as you'll see, this difference in approach really filters down into where we look at fraud on the patent office. And so, as I mentioned, no registration process. So looking at the fraud on the patent office, let's first look at what the law requires and what the patent rules and regulations require of both patent practitioners as well as trademark practitioners. And so patent practitioners have a duty of candor and good faith. This is really sort of honed in on them. And this does mean that they need to disclose where there is prior art. I think this is similar sort of worldwide. And the duty also applies now in any post-grant proceedings. In addition, recently, the PTO put into place new certifications that whoever is filing documents before the PTO, that the matter is stated is the truth to that person's knowledge, that there is evidentiary support for the arguments or claims made, plus that there is a bona fide legal basis for making the arguments. Turning to trademark practitioners, similar, right? They owe a duty of candor and good faith. However, this is less discussed in the trademark space. And interestingly, the duty of candor and good faith does not include a similar duty, to search, right, for prior trademarks, either registered or not registered, that would conflict with your client's mark or with your mark if you are the applicant putting the application together. If you had knowledge of a confusingly similar mark, then the duty would come into play of duty disclosure. But unlike in the patent world, where really that duty of candor and good faith really, in a way, puts this affirmative right on you, in the trademark space, for a practitioner, it's less. As part of the applications, to apply for a registration, the PTO has typically had a number of certifications, that they are the rightful owner of the mark, or their client is. That the mark, and this is something that was mentioned earlier today, that the United States is a use-based system. And so that when you're applying for a trademark, you're either saying you're certifying that either you're using it currently in commerce or you have a bona fide intention to do so. And there's a really short period of time, much shorter than in the UK or the EU, to actually make use of your trademark. And there are ongoing requirements. So if you're representing a client that had a bona fide intention to use a mark for whatever market reasons, they decided to delay, the product launch, you'd have to continually file every 6 months an affidavit of continued intent to use until you can actually file your use in commerce document. In addition, similar on the patent side, you need to certify that you have evidentiary support for your application. And this is actually very interesting in an area that I'm going to talk about coming up, that you are including accurate specimens, particularly of use if your application is based on current use. And these specimens are showing how the mark is being used in commerce. So is it a hang tag, right, for a shirt? Is it the logo, right, on the breast of another product? Is it the logo on a sneaker, right, the swoosh on the sneaker? You need to include a picture, an accurate picture of your specimen. And so that's been actually a problem. Fraud on the patent office. What types of fraud occur? And this is not an exhaustive list, but sort of the greatest hits. On the patent side, there obviously can be spurious applications, as well as claims, right? The entire thing can be, some of the claims can be accurate, others cannot be. And this, as mentioned, does include not disclosing prior art. In addition, the PTO provides for different fee provisions on the patent side, depending on the type of business you are as an inventor. Are you a solo inventor? Are you representing a micro business? These all have specific definitions, because the smaller the entity, the less the fee that you get to pay, in part of the incentivization of the patent system in the United States. And what happens is that some practitioners or applicants will click I am a microbusiness when they really aren't, in order to pay the lower fee. And this does eventually catch up to them, which I'll discuss. On the trademark side, as I mentioned, we have false specimens of use. These can include completely AI-generated images, but also digitally altered images. And one study done by, this is actually the same study that Stuart cited this morning, by professors Barton Beebe and Jeannie Frommer of NYU, they looked at the year 2017. And in this snapshot of time, they found that over a majority of the applications in that year originated from China. And over that majority of those applications included a false specimen of use. And they found that close to 67% of these specimens were fraudulent. And how did they sort of figure it out? They looked specifically, this is very extensive empirical work, They looked at each of these applications to figure out whether or not the mark or the specimen of use had been digitally altered. And as I mentioned, they found that 67% were. Of these, because we didn't have AI back then, but we still had sort of copy and paste. And remember, these are images, right? These are photographs that are being submitted to the PTO. And if you don't have, an examiner, a trademark examiner who's on it, there's a whole other body of literature, right, on both the patent examiners and the trademark examiners and the pressures that are put on them for, timely processing of those applications. So if they're not really taking their time, they can miss this. And so what professors Beebe and Frommer found, that close to 60% of those fraudulent specimens of use proceeded to publication of the mark, and close to 39% of those false specimens of use proceeded to registration. Another alarming trend has been, and I believe this was also mentioned earlier in the day, fraudulent claims of ownership. And so Professor Frommer, with another academic, Mark McKenna from UCLA, published an article last year titled "Amazon's Quiet Overhaul of the Trademark System." If you haven't found it, I highly recommend it. It's eye-opening. Where they found that Amazon's brand registry, and so for those of you who don't know, this was set up to prevent or to counter counterfeiting, right? To counter the claims from big brand owners like Nike, like Rolex, that Amazon wasn't doing anything to combat counterfeiting. They set up a brand registry. And so, you as the brand owner, as a trademark owner, can go and register with them, with Amazon's. And so, it can automate basically your takedown requests. So when you as the brand owner notice that there are counterfeit marks, counterfeit products, then it automates it. And this has incentivized bad actors to fraudulently register a trademark that are in use by others on Amazon and then extort that user to buy the registration back for them, or else they'll shut down their storefront through using the brand registry. And so this has been, just on the rise recently, and professors Frommer and McKenna documented in that really great article. Other types of fraud on the patent office can occur on either side, such as false signatures, impersonating someone else, which is related to the unauthorized representation before the PTO, which on the patent side is both a civil and criminal offense. And this would be where someone pretends to be a registered patent practitioner or forges someone else's signature of an actual practitioner. And this happened in a 2024 case, which involved a firm called Wayne and King IP. And they had filed over 3,000 patent applications with a forged signature of an actual registered patent attorney. And how this attorney found out about it is that they were contacted by the PTO on some anomaly in one of her supposed applications. And she turned around and said, "Well, those aren't mine." And I can only imagine the process that she had to go through to actually prove that those weren't hers. And for trademark applications, this also happens. In one particular case, a practitioner, set up sort of a, I guess derogatorily can be called a mill or trademark mill, where they had non-attorneys working for them. They were sort of the named attorney, and without, reviewing the applications, just allowed those employees to file the applications under his name. And there were many errors, and there were other problems too, as you can imagine, a number of these items also have to deal with them, with the client, what kind of attorney client relationship there's been. Typically when there's fraud on the patent office, there's also misrepresentation or fraud with the client too. For patents, we have something that's been, I think, widely discussed in the American literature called inequitable conduct doctrine. And it's a little close to sort of that abuse of IP right that Amandine was just telling us about. This will come up as a defense in a patent infringement lawsuit. So where the defendant is arguing that they could not have infringed on the plaintiff's patent because it's actually invalid due to the plaintiff's inequitable conduct. And here are the elements. We have first an individual associated with the filing, either misrepresented or submitted false information or omitted information, material information. So that's the difference. And I'm going to talk about with the abuse of IP rights, as Amandine explained to us, we have a materiality requirement here. And as this is not enough, with the specific intent to deceive the PTO. So we really do enjoy in the U.S. looking at sort of the subjective side of abuse. And the patent would not have been granted but for the misrepresentation omission. So a really high bar materiality of this. And as Amandine, you mentioned, you know, intent is hard to prove. And so what courts have done, what the U.S. courts have done is have allowed intent to be, you know, proxies for intent, proxies for that subjective question, what was in the mind of the person, you know, associated with the filing. And so what they have, what the courts have done, and this is a court-made doctrine, you know, not found in the patent statute. And so over time, you know, the courts have been refining it. The courts have found that the intent element is satisfied if there has been egregious conduct, like a false affidavit applied. In addition, an inference of bad intent could be found from a pattern of a lack of candor. So if that same individual associated with the filing has had a pattern of this lack of candor before the patent office, they might then infer the same in that case. The remedies when a court finds inequitable conduct is extremely strict. It is cancellation of the entire patent. So not just a claim, but the entire patent. In addition, there could also be practitioner discipline. And so up until around, I would say, 2011, inequitable conduct was a defense pled in a substantial number of patent infringement cases, and about 40%, and this is based on a number of empirical studies that have been done. There were a couple cases in the 2011, 12, 13 years that have heightened the burden of proving inequitable conduct. And so, as you can imagine, there's then been a decrease of that pleading, of that defense, to around 21%, so almost halved. The success rate, either before and after, has remained low. And right now it's approximately 9% of the time that it's being pled. And you can imagine that sort of makes sense, right? Because cancellation of the entire patent is a serious remedy, right? That is a property revocation. And U.S. courts, and I think this is probably true around the world, that, you know, revocation of a property right is pretty serious, and a court would want really, really good evidence to prove before they did it. You would think then that the other remedy, you know, might practitioner discipline might have a little higher rates, but we haven't found that. And so one study of practitioner discipline, Professor John Lee of Oklahoma, showed that the PTO, and the PTO has, you know, so in the United States, we have both a state system of attorney licensure and the PTO, and with our own, you know, each state has their own regulations. And then the PTO sort of has its own regulations that are sort of layered on top of each of the state's regulations. And so the PTO then has its own, in a way, maybe similar to the IP reg that we were talked to just recently about. Have an office that does investigations of practitioners. And so this professor's empirical piece looked at all of the discipline that took place, because it's all publicized. It's all on a webpage. You can go on the PTO's website and see all of the disciplinary actions that the PTO has taken against practitioners, both in terms of you know, patent agents, as well as patent attorneys and trademark attorneys. This empirical study showed that the PTO didn't really actually discipline patent practitioners all that much, even though it was more often than trademark practitioners. And also interestingly, when the PTO did discipline patent practitioners, it wasn't actually for anything related to inequitable conduct or spurious claims. It was more related to diligence of the attorney in the prosecution of the case, as well as communicating with their clients, right? So, you know, situations where an attorney, you know, just gets too busy, right? They get in over their head. They've taken on too many cases, too many clients, and they're just not keeping up with the calendar. And so they forget to file, you know, responses to office actions, and they forget to tell their client, and then, you know, the patent is denied because they failed to meet, you know, meet the deadline, and they don't tell their client. And so those are the types of cases that were the most disciplined at the PTO, not cases, you know, even though, you know, when you talk to patent practitioners, when you read the literature, you think, oh, there is such a focus on this inequitable conduct, as well as the duty of candor, but there really isn't any enforcement of it. On the trademark side, there is a doctrine akin to the inequitable conduct doctrine, but similar to how the PTO handles sort of trademark practitioners, it's not quite as fleshed out, and it's not as, I guess, seriously developed. Here are the elements. You have a knowing false statement, and again, the specific intent to deceive. The remedies are similar to that under patents inequitable conduct. Your mark will be canceled, and there could be practitioner discipline. However, really interesting in this space, there was a recent 2023 case where a company made a false post-registration. So they had a registration, and they were simply filing for the incontestability status. And the affidavit was false in some way. I didn't get a chance to go look to see exactly what. The remedy there was not a cancellation of the entire mark, even though that's what the PTO was asking the court to do. Instead, the remedy was that the mark does not have incontestable status. And so that was a really interesting read of the statute, and it was specific to reading the text of the statute. And so, it's a recent case, so, you know, it's hard to know how it's going to affect in the future. And in looking at practitioner discipline, similar to the patent side, not much practitioner discipline. In fact, Professor Lee's study found only 23 cases of trademark practitioner discipline over a 16-year period. But, you know, patent fraud and fraud has become a concern for the PTO. And so the Patent Office has established a patent fraud mitigation unit that investigates sua sponte acts of suspected patent fraud. There is no special unit for trademarks. The unit has publicized its work. And so since 2023, when it was established, it's found over 3,900 falsified signatures. They've discovered over 2,200 fee deficiency, and they've issued those notices. And they have then collected over $1.6 million, or it's approximately 1.2 pounds in today's money. Even though the PTO does not have a special unit for trademark fraud, they have recently, just last year, found that there was one foreign filing firm that had filed more than 52,000 fraudulent applications and also received registrations on a bulk of them. They canceled those marks or any pending applications. And this foreign filing firm sought out U.S. licensed attorneys. So, you know, since 2019, we've had a requirement that you have, if you're a foreign applicant, that you have a U.S. Attorney and with a domicile in the United States. They sought out U.S. attorneys. They misused the U.S. attorney's credentials. They faked their electronic signatures. And then repeatedly signed documents using other people's names, and then finally submitted those fake specimens of use. So really just real bad actor and really amazing. I mean, you can't get any worse than that, right? And so amazing that the PTO only recently found this. So it's kind of interesting finding. Moving quickly to trademark bullying. You know, this is, I mentioned, it's sort of an interest of mine. So similar to abuse of IP, trademark bullying is a concern in the U.S. And so how does one define, though, trademark bullying? And there are a number of slightly different definitions, but the one that I use has three elements. The first is that there is an unreasonable interpretation of the trademark owner's rights. And then it is used against a smaller or slightly or a less resourced party. And then finally, they use intimidation tactics. And there are always issues with definitions, particularly when you use the term reasonability. Others would perhaps say that the unreasonability should be maybe more an unfounded interpretation that the law would not support. Either way, for me, though, it's really the last two elements that are really the markers of abuse or bullying when dealing with smaller or less resourced parties. You know, I think in general, one as a practitioner, one needs to take care. So, these organizations or, single folks, entrepreneurs, will most likely not have access to an attorney. And in the U.S., we have ethical responsibilities, I'm sure the same is here, when you communicate with unrepresented parties. So we just need to take care. And then finally, intimidation tactics are also key. It's not just the enforcement of the mark. Of course, you need to have a strategic plan for how are you going to enforce your trademark. Enforcing it is going to be jarring, to the opposing party, particularly if they're a small business. But it's really how the enforcement happens and how is it framed. Sending a cease and desist letter, where a small business has maybe 10 days to respond or else, is an intimidation tactic that does seek to coerce the target into capitulating. And we don't have a groundless threats action in the United States. Our cease and desist letters can be as nasty as they want it to be. What are some causes? I'll get through this fairly quickly. I think this is fairly unobjectionable, but trademarks are valuable, right? It's rational that one would want to protect trademarks because, to the nth degree, because they are so valuable. The world's top brands are individually valued at some small country GDPs, right? Billions and billions. And in today's digital world, having a strong mark helps you stand out where we are all overloaded with images and advertising. The second, and this piece, I'm working on a new article with some co-authors talking about a perceived duty, in quotation marks, to police your mark. There's actually no duty in the United States. It's a perceived duty. There are some consequences, perhaps, if you don't do anything, but that's not what I would suggest. And I understand in the UK, Lionel and I were having this conversation this morning, it's slightly more of a duty. There's more affirmative duty on you. But you'll hear from particularly more of the well-known trademark bullies that they over-enforce their marks because of this duty, and if they don't, they'll lose their marks to genericide or abandonment. But in the United States, the test for continuing to keep your mark is ongoing use and the ongoing distinctiveness of your mark. So what does that mean? There's only so much a trademark owner can do if their mark or product goes viral and becomes the generic term for their new product, right? Think thermos or trampoline I can think of a whole lot of others. And adding to this are statutory and other legal incentives in the United States. Particularly, we have dilution law that provides extra broad protection to famous marks. And so a lot of times what the trademark owner is really doing is trying to become a famous mark. And then finally, there's just lack of consequences for bullying. Like I said, we don't have a groundless threats action. Courts don't really, I'm going to get to this in a second, courts don't really provide attorney's fees shifting. And so given, though, that the targets are small businesses without the resources most likely to hire an attorney, let alone to file a declaratory judgment action, I focus a lot on non-judicial remedies or deterrence, and one is shaming. A recent case of this was a recent successful case was Momofuku, an Asian food company by celebrity chef David Chang, and their bullying of other Asian businesses that use the term chili crunch. And so the other Asian businesses took to social media to shame Momofuku, such that it was about a week or two later, David Chang dropped their claim, Momofuku's claim, to chili crunch as a trademark. Another related non-judicial tool is boycott, but that is tricky. And I do have Target up here because there was a recent boycott of Target, not trademark related, but just shows the power of the purse, where their stock, because of this Target, went down by 30%, which is a pretty major thing for companies. In the judicial realm, Trademark bullying has been tried as a legal defense, but has not yet been successful. In the statute, trademark statute, we do have a provision to shift attorney's fees because in the U.S., as a reminder, we each party generally pays for their own attorney's fees. In exceptional cases, a judge can order a shifting of the fees, but unfortunately, they're not awarded very often, and so much that they're not really seen as a deterrent. We also have something really interesting called an anti-SLAPP or anti-strategic lawsuits against public participation, which is where a trademark owner sues an alleged infringer, and the infringer defends by saying that the owner is simply trying to stifle their freedom of speech or their participation in greater society. And this could happen, for example, where you have a blog review using the trademark owner's mark as part of the review. It's not very kind, maybe, to the trademark owner. And the trademark owner brings the lawsuit to stop their use of it. And the defense could be an anti-SLAPP law. But these are state-based. Not all states have it. It's about 30 states. We don't have yet a federal anti-SLAPP law. And so, you know, really does depend. It comes down to where you can bring your lawsuit. For example, in California, where it has applied anti-SLAPP, it has a fairly strong anti-SLAPP law, and it has applied it in trademark cases. And so in sum, trademark bullying can work, particularly if you are a company that is immune from shaming, kind of like think of Disney, because the organization doesn't care or doesn't suffer a boycott from any shaming. And even if the case gets to court, where the defendant wins their case, it is more likely than not a court would find the trademark owner was simply being zealous as opposed to being abusive. And this is particularly true where plaintiffs were not abusive during the litigation proceedings. Where you do find attorney fee shifting, it's likely that the plaintiff really was just a bad actor during the proceedings, not necessarily in bringing their claim. So while we have a slightly different approach than in the UK, I think we all still have work to do. So thank you.
Thank you, Leah. So again, trademark bullying points up this difference between internal and external correction mechanisms. So we have anti-SLAPP provisions now in this jurisdiction, but I don't think they would help you with trademark bullying. But one thing that would help you, at least in theory, is as well as threats, of course, we've got the Declaration of Non-Infringement. And in theory, if you're the recipient of trademark bullying, you've got a remedy because you can apply in IPEC and get a DNI. But of course, the problem is, can you pay for it? And I think that's possibly why the remedy of shaming is increasingly via social media is increasingly been employed in this jurisdiction. In the last couple of years, we've seen a fair amount of that in cases of at least perceived trademark bullying, whether they were or were not, is another matter. Right, so we have a bit of time for questions and discussion, including people who were burning to ask questions of some of our earlier speakers. So Stuart and David and Daniel, they're still here. So if you were burning to ask them questions earlier, or indeed Trevor or Katerina or Quentin or Philip, now's your chance, or any other observations. So who would like to go first?